Hey everybody, this is John Fusco from No Film School, and this week we have an excellent panel of filmmakers on the show to talk about the challenges associated with filming documentary internationally and how you can prepare for the unexpected, or at least, as best you can. Dun-dun-dun. Okay, enjoy. So I'm going to ask you guys to introduce yourselves and also to tell us a little bit about your latest project that you've done abroad. So let's start with Ariana.
Okay. I'm Ariana Lepenne. I'm a director and cinematographer. I shoot a variety of stylized documentary content, whether it's feature, short, commercials, television. A lot of what I do is shot internationally. I just shot and co-directed a piece for the New York Times with Too Young to Wed Foundation, and that is about child marriage in Nepal. And so we were there for a couple of weeks, and then the piece just got released on the website a week or two ago. And the Viceland TV show called Woman, which is executive produced and hosted by Gloria Steinem. And that is about the plight of women around the world. It kind of looks at how violence against women is an indicator of the dysfunctionality of a nation. And for that show, I traveled to Colombia and did an embed with the FARC. I also did some episodes about sexual assault in the military in the United States and motherhood in prison in the United States.
And this is all for the Woman Vice show?
That's for Woman, yeah, the Viceland show. And the other project I'm concurrently been working on, all in the same time space, is I directed and shot two commercials for West Elm in India. And I've been working on a series for Glamour about young women and their challenges in achieving their educational goals in different parts of the world. So I have not been getting a lot of sleep lately. I've been doing a lot of travel. So
great. Let's move on to Alex.
My name's Alex Malice. I'm a filmmaker. I kind of do it all. I direct and shoot and edit and produce and PA if necessary. The latest project I did abroad was actually with Brian Chang here. Was a short documentary that we shot in Cuba about a tattoo artist who operates in a legal gray zone in Cuba. It was actually a very quick project, which is kind of the style I always end up gravitating towards, where it was just shot in essentially an afternoon. And it's about this guy who basically in Cuba there are only a couple of hundred types of legal private businesses that you can operate, because it's historically, you know, the last 50 years been a totally communist state-controlled country, they've started to allow a few different types of businesses, owning a hotel, running like a bed and breakfast, or running a restaurant, being a clown at a party, kind of hyper-specific things like that. And unfortunately, tattooing, you know, owning and operating a tattoo parlor is not one of them. So we hung out with this guy for an afternoon and cruised around Havana and shot with him.
You went all the way to Cuba for an afternoon?
All the way to Cuba for now. We were there. We were actually there for a film festival, the International Latin American Film Festival. It has a really long and convoluted name in Spanish. It's this big film festival in Cuba that Brian and I were also there for our narrative film, a short film that we had shot in Cuba the year year or two before. So we were there and we brought a camera and did some shooting, because why not?
I saw that film.
Which
your
one?
Film.
The Che one or the
La Noche
Buena? Yeah. Do you like it?
Yeah.
You have to say yes.
And we'll have like links to all these shows and content on our website with the accompanying article, so you guys should definitely check them out. And Brian, you're the producer for Alex's latest, and the cinematographer too, right?
And co-director.
Yeah. And co-director.
And co-director, cool.
So yeah, I've worked with Alex a bunch. We're both part of the Meerkat Media Film Collective that does a lot of documentary work all over. And so yeah, like Alex, I'm a filmmaker. I shoot and edit and produce, direct. And so, yeah, Alex and I had these two recent films, one fiction and one documentary that we made in Cuba. Also recently, I'm in post-production right now on a feature-length documentary about, it's called Island Soldier, and it's about soldiers from Micronesia who serve in the U.S. military, even though they're non-U.S. citizens. And it follows several young men as they enlist and ship out, and it's kind of an investigation into their motivations. Why would they serve for this country that's not theirs, this long history with the U.S. and Micronesia, them being liberated after World War II from Japanese rule, living through decades of being a U.S. territory, and then since the 80s being a sovereign nation, but still having this very unique relationship with the U.S. And it's really the story that people don't really know about. People maybe don't know where Micronesia is when I usually tell them about this story. So yeah, the film hopefully is going to shed some light and exposure to that story that's out there.
So that's a good lead into sort of my first question, which would be, I mean, we're starting with the inception of, I guess, the idea for filming whatever you want to film abroad. It seems like it can come from two or three different sources, whether it's, you know, someone gives you sort of a lead or if it's out of your own volition. What do you prefer, I guess? Do you prefer, is there some blurring of the boundary? Is it always a sort of passion project when you're going out in international territories and you're shedding light on these things that people won't necessarily know?
People usually love international work, but it is actually really hard.
Yeah.
Especially when you're working, when it's a job and you're working for someone, it's very different than when you're working for yourself. Basically, when you're working internationally, you have to realize that things will always go wrong. And so when you're working on your own film, you're managing the expectations around things going wrong and knowing how to problem solve for it are different than when you're working with a client. Mm-hmm. You know? So I think what comes up more, though, is that I constantly have this conversation with producers, which is that I'm very used to how things go. And I try to prepare them that they can't expect things to go according to plan like they do in New York City. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, like even on this last shoot, you know, our flight got super delayed, and it's not the kind of delay where, you know, and you can look on your phone and see when the flight is being rescheduled. It was like, we're just in this country and in Africa, and you know, there's nowhere nearby that we can go to another airport, and there's no one at the counter telling us why, and there's no one even telling you when they're going to come back to the counter. And when you call on the phone, they don't know what this delay is. They don't even have the information, hasn't even gotten to them yet. Mm-hmm. So there, you know, there's a lot of things like in terms of scheduling and learning how to prepare for the unexpected.
So how do you prepare for the unexpected? As best you can. I mean,
yeah, I mean, you do things like you don't schedule things back to back because things like that can happen very easily. You could have like a roadblock. You could have something go wrong with the vehicle. There's always a chance that things will go wrong with the vehicle. You always bring way more water than you thought you were going to need. And I end up having arguments with like the people that I hire locally about this sometimes, because I always super over prepare because I've been in every one of those situations where something's, you know, something has gone wrong, because something always will. And you just can't expect for things to go smoothly. But you also have to have a really good temperament, I think, and be able to resolve conflicts with people, you know, strangers that come up, because like lots of things will, you know, things can easily spiral out of control when you have language barriers. And like I shoot news too, and I shoot in dangerous situations sometimes, and so you have to have this like kind of, I guess, unending patience for
So do you have
trouble.
Translators with you for language barrier usually?
Yeah.
On these? Okay.
Yeah, you you want to.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, definitely makes things a lot better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I made my first feature doc was in Serbia, and most of our team just didn't speak Serbian. And so we had a couple of wonderful producers with us that did speak Serbian, but it was interesting because we thought ahead to get those translators, but then we were also shooting in the south of Serbia where a lot of the Roma live. And so amongst themselves, the Roma were speaking in Romani, and they could speak in Serbian, but it was kind of broken Serbian. And so we kind of had to just like go on emotion a lot of the time, you know, seeing like how they were reacting and like, you know, hand gestures. And they, you know, luckily our subjects were very accommodating and, you know, kind of waited for us to figure out what was going on. But a lot of times we were sort of shooting in the dark and just hoping that things would turn out. And it's kind of only later on in post-production that you'd see like what the actual scene was. I'm like, I think something happened there, and you know there was some good emotion. I think that was a good interaction, but sometimes it's not in the moment that
and then you find out that they're just talking about like,
and they're usually talking about us. They're like, oh, can you believe these are the camera guys? We're like,
when they're like screaming at each other, it's super mundane, and when it's super casual and you're not really getting it, it's like the most deep moment ever, and you know you sort of have to just keep rolling because it's sometimes the opposite. Like gestures can differ in different.
Yeah,
countries.
This is one of my greatest questions. Is like, what are they saying about us right now? Like, we are so strange. Like, there's so many places that we come in and we film in like tiny little villages and stuff, and we roll in with the gear and I'm a woman, and so a lot of times that's just like strange for people to see this woman with the big camera like running around rolling in the dirt filming people and stuff, and I'm just thinking like if it would be priceless to me to have translations of what they're saying, because I know
who's that woman, the Laura Poitras's DP who just came
Kristen Johnson.
Yeah, Kristen Johnson's film camera person is a must see if you're thinking mm-hmm. about shooting, yeah. especially abroad. She sort yeah. of deals with that question head on, like what is the interaction that you have with people, especially when it's a much less technological place than New York City, which is often just about everywhere.
Yeah, it's a really good film. I asked her to screen it I just started a group of women cinematographers with a couple of my colleagues, and she is a part of it. It's called Cinematographers XX, and she's going to screen that film because it's right on the money.
That's so good.
It talks about that issue, but also like what kind of connections you make with people, especially people you never see again, and you know what you're asking from them when you are there for just a short period of time, what you're asking them to give to you, and you know what you take away, and whether you're giving something back, which I, you know, as time has gone by, has become much more important to me. Because when you start out and you're young, you're excited to go somewhere, but you know, you have, as time goes by and you've, you know, you think about the people that you never see again, there's a lot of processing about that goes on.
Well, yeah, I imagine there's some sort of sense of responsibility for really, you know, when you're there, coming away with a story that will in some way benefit those people that you're interacting with.
Yeah, you'd hope so.
Yeah.
You know, but like I work as a DP, right? So I don't have control mm-hmm. of things that I shoot over how that turns out. So when you asked earlier about, you know, your involvement when you're shooting something for yourself, or when I'm directing, it's a very important experience for me, because I do get to make sure that what I'm doing is meaningful and that there is a connection with the people. I mean, I can monitor and evaluate that, you know, it's mm-hmm. a totally different situation. But you know, there's a lot of things that get filmed in other countries that the people that you filmed never see it.
Mm-hmm. Well then Alex, I mean, how did you find your subject for the new Che, for Cuba's new Che?
Yeah, that was sort of serendipitous. That was through the producer of our piece, Allison Potash. It was through a friend that she was connected to him. And she and I went over there one afternoon and just checked it out, just kind of hung out with him. And that was, you know, and I think that was a sort of reading about him. I knew, or talking to him, it was sort of, it became clear that he was much more media savvy than the average citizen, let's say. There had been media about him in Vice, in tattoo magazines, and various print publications. And so it wasn't a huge stretch to ask him, you know, what do you think about us coming here with some cameras? But even then, I mean, that is always, you know, filming with him or filming with anyone, it's like you aim for the highest level of of like consent and but at the end of the day, like there's different people have a different amount of media literacy, sort of, you know, what does it mean to be on camera? It's, you know, like when you, in the 90s, when, you know, sort of pre-internet, when a camera in the room meant a different thing than it does, you know, for me at least in 2016, you know instantly this could be on the other side of the planet viewed 10 million times in overnight. And so that's the kind of sensitivity that sometimes is difficult to explain to somebody who, you know, who's not in that world. And then the responsibility falls on you, I think, especially as a director, you have to be...
No, I mean, I think that's the key, is they don't have control over it because you're making the film. And so you have to be careful with that. And, you know, people, when they consent, as you said, depending on their level of media literacy, you have to be careful about that they know what they're consenting to.
Right.
And that's why I think it's good to show people later and for them to be involved in it, because it keeps us more,
yeah.
I don't know what the word is. I don't want to say honest, but well, you know, it keeps us more in check and in tune with the people that we're, you know, connecting with, that there's a connection that's both ways.
So we talked a little bit about the differences between going and shooting a documentary in international territories out of your own volition versus being sort of hired as a contractor. But say this is a passion project, or say this is something that you're doing out of your own volition, what would be your ideal sort of setup, your ideal sort of gear setup? What would you bring with you? How light would you pack? How mobile would you want to be? What kind of camera would you use?
Good question. Brian?
I think it's important to be scalable, for sure. And going back to what we're talking about, and like working with maybe a first-time documentary subject and making sure that they're comfortable and know what they're getting into, I feel like you always it's always kind of a dance to make sure that you're adaptable to whatever situation presents itself, and especially when the stakes are a little higher in an international sort of shoot. Where you know you have the gear that you came with, and you've done as much pre-production as you can, but you know who knows, like maybe the subject doesn't turn out to be very compelling. You meet somebody else, and you know they're the subject that you want to follow, or you're thrown into some situation that you don't anticipate. I think it's useful to be able to like strip down to a tiny little DSLR if you want. Like that's what we shot in Cuban, precisely because we were a little bit worried about being stopped at the airport with a lot of gear. You know, the Cuban government's notorious for being paranoid about who's spying on them. So we're like, oh, we'll just like bring the little camera and go with that. But you know, having the ability to scale up with a nicer monitor or sound setup, but being able to like get down to just that one little camera, run and gun sort of thing, you can get into certain places that you wouldn't with a large apparatus that, you know, some people will see and kind of get freaked out. And a big key to getting good verite documentary footage is just having people be at ease and be themselves. And so you kind of want to like feel that out and present yourself in a smaller way if you need to, but also be able to, you know, shoot nice looking footage.
Yeah, we just had a 5D, a 24-70, a zoom, you know, the classic, what is that, H4N, a Sennheiser lav, and a shotgun. And that was it.
So that's super bare bones.
Yeah, that's about as bare bones as you can get. And I think it's like, it is a testament to skill. I mean, one thing is that like and we had a monitor too, so we had a little top, like a hot shoe mounted monitor. Just that it was so small. And I think especially in a place like Cuba, people still assume, or maybe even in New York, people can still assume that you're taking photos. And it looks like, you know, there's that advantage to having such a tiny little camera.
Although the jig's sort of up on the 5D.
Yeah, maybe the jig's
people
up.
People know that.
Maybe now they
video
know.
Video footage with that.
That's probably true. That's probably true.
I don't want it to become like a camera plug fest, but, and I think that, I really think that it's important to do the right camera for the job, and not, there's no blanket answer, but I tend to use a Canon C300, which I bought and I'm very used to operating with. And I train myself to never need a rig, and that cuts down a lot on what you're transporting. I always bring a couple of zooms and several primes, so I kind of cover my bases. So I always have a 24 to 105 image stabilizer because I do a lot of following shots, walking backwards, walking around people. I always have the 70 to 200 image stabilizer also because I love to do the long lens stuff, especially in other countries. I'll often bring the extender for the 70 to 200 because that really makes a difference. Whether if you're like I was shooting into a deep quarry 2 weeks ago, and having that extender pushes up two times, I can get a lot more. Like those kind of super detail shots of someone, like a body in action, that you wouldn't be able to get with just a 200 mil. And then I always bring a few primes, like a wide prime, like a 24 or a 35, a 50, and sometimes I'll bring like 100 macro. For me, that's like my basic documentary package, because then I can still, even though I'm not using the nicest glass that I'd like to use, which I might use if I had a more controlled environment, I do have the range of tools that I can do a variety of shots, which is important to me because I don't like looking at documentary that feels like when I'm looking at my own stuff, if I don't feel like I'm changing the angle enough or looking at something in a new way. So I usually bring that. I bring two reflector discs that are four-way, so that means that there's a black, white, silver, and gold side. And that's like, you'd be amazed what you can do with a few reflector discs, which is basically like you're setting up, outdoor, silking and flagging.
What do you usually do about power, especially when you're going to be off the grid?
Well, so when I did the embed in Colombia, I had to backpack in with a lot of batteries. It was in a very elaborate conversation.
Yeah, you weren't charging in the field.
We carried everything in.
Dang.
Yeah. And we had to carry food in. As per the U.S. government, you're not allowed to accept any kind of food or gift of any kind from a terrorist group. So we were supposed to bring in all of our own food. So we were like packing in a lot of stuff, packing in cameras, packing in batteries, packing in lenses, packing in food, packing in water.
Did you have to report that you were heading into this quote terrorist group?
I mean, some of the legal stuff is like handled by the company that I was working for. I don't actually know how their legal team, basically deals with this issue, but those were the rules that were then, foisted upon us that we had to deal with in the field. And on that particular scenario, like, we weren't allowed to have any communication with the outside world, so we had to leave our phones in a safe house and just be completely off the grid. So that really makes you think about what you're going to bring, because you're carrying it on your back. But I still brought at least like four lenses, lenses.
How big of a crew were you working with there? I mean,
that was okay. This gets pretty crazy, but I did basically me and the producer. That's it.
So just the two of you were lugging around all that equipment and all that food.
Yes, we had the soldiers that we were working with. That we had people to help us carry it, but not at first, because you have to like walk to a certain spot where they meet you. Mm-hmm. So we carried in. It was me and the producer and the host, and then we had a fixer. And like a local Colombian producer. So like there was enough people to carry stuff, but it's still a lot. Like everybody had to carry a lot. We didn't know how far we were going because they wouldn't tell, we couldn't know where we were going and how far it would take and how long it would take. But I had like a vest that like almost like an easy rig that like a vest that I could snap stuff onto. So I had the camera mounted onto my vest so that I could shoot while I was carrying stuff. And I think we brought the tripod too. Yeah, we did. Yeah.
So that really sounds, like guerrilla filmmaking. I'm making air quotes right now.
Yeah, with gorillas.
Yeah. What does that term mean to all of you? Like, when does filmmaking become guerrilla filmmaking? Like, how would you define guerrilla filmmaking?
when you are working for someone, they're producing some of these situations that need to be figured out. But when you're making your own film, then to me that feels really like guerrilla filmmaking. Like when I was in Israel and the West Bank, like we're making decisions about what to shoot and producing and our contacts and deciding what risks we're going to take and what risks we're going to take with the gear and with our own lives and all the rest of it, and figuring out, you know, how to get ourselves in and out and all the complications that can come from a shoot. To me, that feels like guerrilla filmmaking. I might be taking in the same amount of equipment, actually, but when all the weight is on your own head, then I feel like that's...
Yeah, maybe similarly, the line is sort of like when there are rules that you have to bend. Like, I feel like I'm guerrilla when I'm... didn't get permission to be there, whether it be something as simple as just like an exterior location in New York or a country where you're supposed to be permitted for any, you know, like Cuba, where you're supposed to have a permit to do this type of stuff. But, you know, I think that term, especially nowadays, gets used pretty liberally, and I don't necessarily have a problem with that. As you know, if you're doing something that requires some level of ingenuity or some level of creativeness in term, you know, and that can mean the gear you're using. You know, you're using something like an iPhone and you're just sort of doing it yourself, one person team, then, you know, that can be guerrilla. Or do you have a huge geared out crew, but you're in a place you shouldn't be? Maybe that's guerrilla too.
Right. It seems like the added level of personal risk is what makes it like a guerrilla film shoot.
I mean, and that risk can be emotional too. I mean, it can be a creative risk. I mean, sometimes, again, to sort of employ it liberally, if you're doing something that you feel like you don't have some kind of institutional backing, that sort of mentality that you enter is guerrilla. Like, what corners can I cut? What resources can I bend to serve my ends?
Or maybe resources is kind of what it comes down to. Yeah. Is like just making do with the limited resources that you have, whether that means that you're there on your own or, you know, if you have a small crew, but you have limited amount of time or limited gear that you've brought with you, and just like stretching that as far as possible. And right. I think that especially comes into play when you're international. You like you're there with whatever you brought,
yeah.
And like you got to make it work. And yeah, like Ariana, what you mentioned when you're working on your own thing, I think there maybe is more of a willingness to just stretch yourself or the plan as far as you can get it to like get all the footage that you want, because like that's your thing. You want to like squeeze every drop out of your limited time there. Whereas if you're working for someone else, maybe you're more inclined to just like put in your hours and like do a good job.
I feel like I always push myself too far, no matter who I'm working for.
Okay. Yeah,
but enough. I won't take risks on other people. If it's for like, if for me, like guerrilla filmmaking, the thing is the repercussions are on my head and I'm willing to take risks for myself, but I don't want to put other people in a problematic situation. And you know, like when we went to the jungle in Colombia, like I'm not going to do that and do it halfway. That's like a 200% kind of, you know, you have to be willing to like really go the limit. In that situation, I'm glad I wasn't doing it on my own for my own film exactly, because you know there are certain, you want to have certain protections that like certain
fail safes or escape.
Yeah,
out.
I mean, I don't know if we felt safe, but at least like
somebody knew you were there.
They did, but they didn't know where we were. So I mean, it's probably one of the least safe things you could do. But you know, at least there's some kind of resources that you could tap into if something did go wrong, which are different than your personal resources.
Right.
There's, yeah, it's like you have the backup people like in the helicopter.
There's somebody sort of back there somewhere,
right. Yeah.
That when they do, if they do find out where you are, they can try to do something
exactly.
About it.
So what are some of the most intense challenges you guys have faced in guerrilla filmmaking?
Well, this was a narrative I was working on in the DR Congo and in like a very remote region in the far, far northeast. And I think, you know, it's nothing revelatory. It's just sort of obvious things like electricity, like how are we going to charge the batteries, or something like, where are we going to eat today? How are we going to find food? You know, we maybe have forgot to figure out where we're going to find lunch. And then it's like, there's no restaurant. There's no there's, you know, I'm not going to be the obnoxious one and say there's no Yelp, but like there's no, you know, those kinds of things. Well, I guess I just did. I just did. Oh, God. Those kinds of basic things that you take for granted in a place in the United States, in many, most parts of the United States, you take for granted, can catch up with you. And then I think the biggest challenge also can be language, and that's something that we touched upon earlier. Not knowing what's being said directly in front of you is a humbling experience always. It's sort of like a blessing and a curse. On the one hand, you if you don't understand what's being said, it almost frees you up from that part of your brain that's required to process language and allows you to focus on other things or to consider other things, maybe be a better way of saying it. You know, body language, gesticulation, you know, the landscape, the scenery, the future, the past, you know, just this, you know, more abstract ideas that can maybe get lost when you're too obsessed with what people are saying. This one shoot we were doing, it was a narrative shoot and the script was in English. The translators were translating into French and then the actors were delivering the lines in this tribal language, Zande. And it, you know, one particular story was that we sort of said, can you tell them to do it faster? Ask them to do it faster, you know, deliver the lines faster. And then that got translated, you know, 2-3 languages. And then they had this, and the way that he delivered the line was like, it was like 5 sentences. And we're sort of wondering like, what is he? And then they had something to say to that and he had something to respond to that. And there was this sort of back and forth where we're sort of wondering what the heck are they saying?
Yeah, kind of like telephone.
Yeah, it was a game of telephone, yeah. I think.
It seems like some of the common challenges are, you know, like what the limited resources you have, yeah, that you bring with you, the gear, yeah. The language barriers.
And I think security.
Security.
Yeah, security. You know?
I mean, I feel like when I'm doing something on my own, that's when the, you know, like there have been some times like filming in Turkey and Egypt where it's just like you have like these run-ins with the police and you just really, you get that feeling of you're not in a, you know, when you're not in a free country and you don't have the rights that we are sort of feel very entitled to in the United States, when you're doing guerrilla filmmaking and you don't have anyone to back you up, that's when that's been like my primary concern.
I think also just realizing it in certain places that you stick out. I think when I'm behind the camera, often I feel kind of invincible for whatever reason because I'm holding the camera and I'm like just in my monitor and like in the zone. But one example I can think of is being in Serbia where we were shooting in a rural part of the country. And just no one had ever seen an Asian person before, much less one holding a camera. So I would get shouted at everywhere I'd go. They'd be like, "Oh, China, China TV," and I'm like, "No, not from China." But you know, we were filming at this music festival. So it was for this film called Brasslands about brass bands in Serbia, like the Woodstock of trumpet bands. And it was this big, week-long, rowdy, drunken music festival, and full of these like bro-y nationalist Serb type guys who were wasted and, you know, having a good time. But there was also just like this undercurrent of like nationalist fervor underneath everything, and we were like we were aware of that going in, but you know, kind of night to night we're filming and there would be guys coming up to us like trying to pick fights or trying to like yell at me, and I, you know, obviously I also didn't speak Serbian, and so it'd be hard to kind of negotiate that and talk them down or, you know, try to figure out whether to smile and joke around with them or kind of take a firmer line and be like, "Hey man, like you're getting in my shot, maybe like keep walking." And you know, the language barrier is an added gap there that you have to try to negotiate. But I guess just being aware that I stuck out was something that like came to me on that trip that I hadn't. That was kind of my first feature foray like outside of the States, and realizing that it was just very different when I didn't have access to the same sorts of things that I had here in the U.S. or that I couldn't just blend into the background in the same way that I would here in New York, where like everybody's from everywhere.
Well, Ariana, I mean, as a woman, I imagine you must encounter some similar problems as, that you stand out that, you know, in these different cultures.
Yeah, I stand out a lot. It's like, I'm a woman, I have red hair, I'm like this tall, strange, like funny freckled person, you know, like, yeah, I just kind of like just steamroll through, like it makes total sense to the point where like people just have to get used to it. I don't address it. I move really fast when we're shooting internationally. We always have so much to get done. And so I'm just like very direct with people. I feel like what I do is I take them by surprise so they don't have chance to dwell on the fact that they're not used to this situation. And that's just sort of been my methodology over time. But also from shooting overseas a lot, I have really gotten used to sort of understanding what people are saying, even when I don't speak their language. I have learned a lot about body language, tone, and communication, other forms of communication. So, which helps a lot, you know, when a situation gets tense or when you're trying to figure out what your next move is. And
it sounds like that also could influence just the way you shoot a film. I mean, like Alex was saying, you tend to capture some of the greatest performances when you not ignore dialogue, but when you're more focused on sort of the gesture and the sort of meaning behind it.
Yeah, and all the, you know, every place has their own, like over traveling for a while, I've noticed like there's unique little like signs that each culture makes. Like there's a lot of like hand gestures and head gestures and things that people do that each like country or region or culture has its own version of it, but there's actually like a universality to it also. And
I find too that there's a level of projection that often happens as a filmmaker in a foreign place where whatever you think you would feel like or whatever you assume they're feeling like is how you perceive the situation. And sometimes that can be prohibitive or can cause you to sort of misinterpret what's happening, and sometimes it's as simple as saying, you know, waving them over and showing them the monitor and saying, check it out. You know, more times than not, filming abroad, it's the biggest emotion or the biggest dynamic that I come across is one of curiosity. Mm-hmm. You know, what are you up to? What is that? And you know, obviously, most people understand what a camera is, and they just want to know. They want to see, and
they want to know about you.
They want to know about you. You know, just as much. You know, you're not invisible. In fact, you're the very opposite of that. And they're curious, and they want to see what. And it makes people so happy. I find, without fail, I would say, well, I'm sure there are exceptions, but the vast majority of the time, when you wave someone over to look through the monitor and check it out, they smile. They say, "Wow, this is super cool." And that can, the conversations that come out of that sometimes can be so much more valuable than you might assume, and can move you forward in some cases. There's a willingness because you sort of assume, you know, in verite filmmaking, for example, you want people to ignore the camera. And a misconception might be that you want them to remain ignorant of the camera, and that those are two different things. If they know what's happening and they're comfortable with it, then the type of content you're able to capture will be much stronger than if they're ignorant, you know, by your part as to what exactly this thing is you're doing and what you're doing it for. And that, you know, relates to what we were talking about earlier with having these conversations about, you know, to the best of your ability about what it is you're doing and what it means for them to appear there. And, you know,
I really agree. Yeah. I think that's a really important point. This comes up a lot. I think, or at least it comes up to me. It comes up for me where I think it's important to really explain to people what you're doing. And most of the time there, you know, people are worried about, as you would be as well, you're worried about how you'll appear on camera. How are you going to come off? Like, you know, most people have an idea of what could happen. And even if they don't, you know, people are just concerned that, like, why are you filming me? Am I weird? Am I strange? Am I ugly? You know, like, so it's helpful to just, be straightforward with people. Show them what you're doing. Totally true. People are just curious. Yeah. They're, like, interested in what is it you're capturing in that box? And a lot of times with, you know, fixers and stuff, I'll really try to like make sure that they're actually explaining to people who we are and why we're there, and making sure that they actually ask people if it's okay. Because a lot of times people will be like, no, no, it's fine, it's fine. It's a small village. Everyone's friendly here. Like, it's fine. You can just take their picture. But it's good to actually engage with people directly and make sure it's okay and share it with them a little bit, because I agree. Like, you'll get a lot more warmth and exchange out of that.
And sometimes the fixer is more concerned with
getting you what you want.
Yes. And they're more willing to look over, the small village, et cetera.
Right.
And related to that, too, I find that this applies, everywhere, not just internationally. Sometimes you walk in the door and you see what's happening, and because it's the first time you've seen it, your instinct is to start rolling immediately because you don't want to miss a second of it, and you feel this like anxiety inside of you. If your camera is not rolling immediately, you're missing valuable content. And that is just, that can be such a huge mistake, to not take the time, whether it be a minute, as little as 1 minute, or as much as a full conversation or a share a meal, to really make sure that people, to do what we just talked about, to make your presence known, to make sure your intentions are clear, to introduce yourself. And then, and those moments that you've, every filmmaker has the story of the time they weren't rolling, or the thing they missed, or they deleted the card, and
it's going to happen for the rest of your filmmaking life. You're going
to
miss some moments.
You're going to miss them. So,
and you just
so embrace
learn,
it.
Yeah. Or like, you'll learn that there will be other moments.
Yeah. And another quick aside about we're going back to gear, I feel like always have some kind of backup, like ultra emergency backup, which for me can be an iPhone. Like, bring an iPhone or bring a GoPro or something. Like, I always sort of think like, okay, if my entire, when we were going to Congo, we had the FS700, is that a camera? Think so.
Yeah,
we had the FS700 and like a sound, a four-track recorder and all these mics, and then we had a DSLR and a Zoom and iPhone, iPod headphones. And it's like, okay, if this gear gets stolen or broken or lost or it fails, we have a plan B.
Always
something, and I feel like I would be so mad at myself if I didn't bring an iPhone, because you can get, nowadays you can get super decent footage, with a phone, and that's so much better than nothing.
It seems like, sort of embracing these differences between like you and your subject, and like just getting to the level where both you and your subject recognize the differences between like yourselves or your cultures, and accepting them, and sort of, I guess, building your relationship off of that, off of those differences, can really contribute to a successful documentary internationally.
Just to remember that it's not only about what you want and what you need and what you came to get. And those are all ways of encapsulating the idea of what you came to film. But with film shoots, we can get so wrapped up in like, we have to get this, quote unquote. And like, you have all this money and the gear that you got and you rented or whatever, and you brought these people to come here and help you make it and all this stuff. But there are other people on the other side of the line of that literal, the line that we call it, the filmmaking 180 degree line. And they matter. And they... what you leave behind, has an effect in the world. So, especially when you're internationally working, it's important to think about the effect that you have on the people you leave behind.
Yeah, I think the camera is inherently, any camera you're taking. I mean, take a picture, take an image. It's implicit in the instrument itself. Which makes it all the more important to be aware of ways that you can be, you can try to counteract that, I guess, sort of listen and be present. And especially as an American, part of this country, with such an imperialistic history, to be aware when you're in another country that you come with all that. And just because you believe a certain thing, or you know deep down inside you're a good person, doesn't mean that you're free of those politics. When you have a camera in your hand, it's only amplified. All the more reason to think through what it is you're doing in this place, and who it is you're doing it for.
Right, especially because you're planning to represent someone.
Yeah.
I think it's really, it's easy to fall into maybe this trap of when you go to another place that it's exotic. It's like these different people, this different environment that that you're like interested to see, and that's great. But as filmmakers, we're trying to make some sort of like real connection with that subject. We're trying to like portray something truthful about whatever the subject matter is. And so, yeah, what you guys were talking about of like it being equally important to establish that connection off camera in order to portray that when you're actually rolling. Because if you just go in there, guns blazing, you know, camera rolling, you know, people are going to get freaked out, or they're not going to know what your intentions are. And I think, yeah, that's just especially important to keep in mind when you're in a foreign place where, you know, maybe it's a little more uncomfortable to go and just like talk to somebody, or there's like that added layer of translation that you have to go through. Mm-hmm. But it's always worth it to make that connection first, and then you know, hopefully you're able to be more truthful, more real in the subject that you're capturing.
It's funny because, you know, guerrilla filmmaking sort of has this aggressive sort of connotation with it, and it seems like
another
it's really,
war metaphor.
Yeah, it seems like it's more about sensitivity in a way, you know, and like treating the situation with respect, and you know, coming to it at a reasonable angle.
Maybe that's a documentary angle. Hopefully.
Yes. Very good. Yes.
Definitely. Anytime you pick up a camera. Yeah. It's a huge responsibility to hold a camera in your hand, especially when you have access to the resources that likely the three of us, four of us do, the kind of outlets that we have access to, the kind of potential that a piece that we might be a part of creating has to reach a huge audience and to represent someone. And sometimes that might, you know, in some cases that might be the most like far-reaching representation of a person that may exist in the world. And that's a huge responsibility.
All that said, though, I was going to say, I think it's great that there are so many small and lightweight cameras and no film school outlets like this, like encourage people to democratize filmmaking. Yeah, and we have so many tools available to us. And I might use this camera, but there's tiny cameras like the Sony a7S II or the new FS5 that's mm-hmm. so light. I was just playing with it yesterday. You can go out and, you know, learn in the field about the technology with that sensitivity in mind, and you can have the ability to tell really interesting, great stories from all places all around the world and share it with people.
Yeah. And you're going to make mistakes. Like, you know, what we've said here is obvious, you know, is based off experience. And I've had, you know, I may sound like I've got it all figured out, but that doesn't mean there's so many times I've been out in the field and just like pointed my camera the wrong place at the wrong time, or just, you know, done something in ignorance, or I didn't think something through properly. And that's going to happen. And we're not trying to create fear. We're just, you know, or rather.
Well, those are the biggest moments you learn.
Yeah, you have to try
and
fail.
Lesson one, things will go wrong. Lesson two, you will make mistakes.
Yeah.
I don't have a lesson three.
All that stuff.
I was like, wait, what's lesson three? What's lesson two? Keep going.
Oh, lesson three, you'll learn, right?
That's lesson four, point, right? Don't go to film school.
Yeah, don't go to film school. Well, lesson five is just get a camera and if you have an idea, shoot it.
Just do it.
Learn it.
That seems to be the common advice for a lot of these, the common, I guess, conclusion for a lot of these podcasts is just like,
just do it.
Just do it. Yeah. Just get out there.
Yeah. I went to film school, but I learned everything on the job, not in school.
Same.
Totally. Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Cool.
It's been real.
Thanks. This is fun.
Check me out on MySpace.
Yeah. Please check out the article that's going to accompany this. We'll send a link to, we'll place a link for Alex Malice's MySpace. He's got some cool vids up there. We'll put links in for a lot of the content we've been talking about tonight. And as always, you know, subscribe, rate, review us on iTunes. We're doing well. We'd love to do better.
Woo.
Rating actually matters, it turns out.
Rating matters.
It does. Yeah.
That should be a t-shirt.
Rating matters.
Nowadays.
You can buy that t-shirt at No Film School.
I wear it.
Soon. All right, guys. Thanks for listening.